Hi, I'm Jen. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 11, 2005. I have a home group. I belong to the Jaywalkers home group, and we're in Richmond, Virginia, and we meet on Tuesdays and Fridays, and we have babysitting, which is a blessing. And I have a sponsor, and she came up with me today, and I'm very nervous. And I'm glad I didn't fall. I was praying I wasn't going to fall. I've been asked to talk about surrender, and I was asked, I think, like 6 months ago to come here. And we were in the car on the way down, and they were asking me what are my experiences about surrender. And I've had like 6 months to be prepared, but I don't know. I don't know what to say. So I will just tell my story, and I hope that there's a lot of surrender in my story. My first experiences of drinking alcohol, I was at the end of eighth grade, and by the time, about a year and a half later, in the middle of 10th grade, I was hospitalized at the Psychiatric Institute of Richmond for 6 weeks for alcoholism. And that's really what my alcoholism looks like. I become sick fast. And I can become sick very fast today if I am not diligent. I love how we are reminded that it's the maintenance of our spiritual condition that keeps us well. It's not my spiritual condition that keeps me well. It's the maintenance, meaning it's the action, it's the work, it's what I'm doing every day. And when I am lazy, it really does not take me so long to get sick. So it's in this treatment center, and I just thought that was outrageous. I couldn't believe that I was tricked. My parents said, we're going to take you to the hospital because you're out of control. Do you want to go? And I had to meet with a psychiatrist, and I thought I was going to be like in a room with a TV and a button to call the nurse to bring me snacks, and I didn't know. But it was going to be like a lockdown facility where people got thorazine when they didn't behave. And that was my first experiences of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous was when I was in that treatment center. And about a year ago, I was at a facility called Rubicon, which is in Richmond, Virginia, and it's a long-term residential treatment facility for women. And many of the women who go there opt to go there instead of serving a sentence in jail. And we're sitting in the cafeteria, and the speaker said that was the Psychiatric Institute of Richmond many years ago, and I didn't know that. And I had been going there a couple times a month for many months, sitting in the same cafeteria where I had like eaten lunch and breakfast and all of that for 6 weeks. And I'm sorry to say that my mom and dad really spent my college education in that treatment center. And the only thing I learned in that treatment facility was, oh, there are other things out there that you can enhance your alcohol experience. And although my mom took me to meetings and sat beside me in meetings when we went back home to, I grew up in Fredericksburg, did not stick. I did not think I was an alcoholic. I thought that, the psychiatrists were tricking my parents into admitting me there so they could get $30,000 out of Blue Cross Blue Shield. That's what I believed. And my alcoholism just progressed. And my experience as a teenager was that I really thought that my parents were lousy parents. I thought that my father was very quick to anger. He was a very physical disciplinarian, and my mother struggled with a lot of health problems, and I felt very abused and neglected. And in retrospect, what I've gotten to see from being sober and taking the steps that are here in this program and doing an inventory, that this is the kind of daughter that I was. I spray painted curse words on the wall in my bedroom because I was angry with my parents. I set my parents' house on fire because I was angry with them because they wanted me to go somewhere with them as a family and I didn't want to participate. And I got in trouble. So I thought, if I set the kitchen on fire, then they'll have to feel sorry for me because this traumatic event has happened to me. It's bad. My dad got up at 4:30 every morning and drove to Washington, D.C. from Fredericksburg, which is about an hour, to go to his job at the Pentagon, so that we could go to private school and we could live in a nice home in the suburbs and I could never have to want for anything. Nothing. They gave me everything that I could have needed in January, and I worked for a couple months part-time in D.C. these last few months, and in January I had to be in D.C. by 9 o'clock in the morning, so I got to get up at 4:30 in the morning to get ready to go. And as soon as I woke up, I was just blown away by the thought that my father did that every day for years, my whole life coming up, so that my mother could stay at home and so that we could have this nice and good life. And, you know, I set their home on fire and I spray painted curse words on the wall and I ran away from home 30 times, because I didn't like the way that they treated me. I thought they abused me and it was unfair. My dad is the person who got to pick me up when I was 15 years old on New Year's Day from the emergency room at Mary Washington Hospital because I had a blood alcohol content of 0.32. My dad is the person who got to come to my high school and pick me up when I was in 10th grade because I ate a box of Benadryl and a bottle of Advil because I just wanted to die. And I was walking down the hallway in high school throwing up and throwing up and throwing up, and I got sent to the clinic. You know, that's the kind of daughter that I was. When I got at 20, when I was out of control and I was living in, I had a baby, a two-year-old baby who slept on the floor in my apartment where I had, crowds of vagrants who made a living selling illegal substances coming over and partying, and no electricity, and running a power cord out the window to the soda machine in the alley so that we could have lights, and using all kinds of substances. That's how out of control I became. And it was suggested to me by a man who taught me how to smoke crack cocaine that maybe I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I called my parents. At this point, I was there for several months, and after a few months into it, I sent this baby home to my mom and dad to raise because this was not an environment that she should live in. And that is alcoholism, that I don't want my baby sleeping on the floor in that kind of environment because I know that's not a good environment for her, but I can't stop doing that, so I have to send her somewhere else. That's what my alcoholism looks like. And so I went into this treatment center and I called my mom and dad from this treatment center and I said, I'm in treatment for alcoholism and for smoking crack cocaine. I don't have anywhere to live. Can I come home and live with you? And they said, yes. And I went and I lived with them and my baby, who was two. And my father said, Jen, if you go back to college and you go to AA, you can live here as long as you need to, and we'll take care of you. And so I went to AA, and I thought, I'm coming to AA because I'm thinking that clearly things are out of control, and the father of my baby wants to take me to court and get custody of her, and I'm not going to let him win that because it's not okay for you to tell me that something is wrong with me. And I've already been in and out of the court system. I've already had a DUI. I have, I've I've already just made a mess of my life. So it makes sense to me that I need to do something different, but I'm not interested in your program of action. I'm just interested in getting the heat off of me. I'm interested in meeting the boys who are in AA. I'd like to have a place to live that's not a treatment center. And this is what I have to go do. I didn't know that then. I didn't understand that. I really believed that I was there. I was in AA, and I was there to do what you do. And I did not know until getting sober this time and having the opportunity of looking back and seeing how I wasn't really participating in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was there before. And back in my mind, I just really thought that, well, you guys just, you were not as smart as me. That was your main problem. And just a lot of the things that you said were just goofy to me. You know, the whole notion of a higher power was really goofy to me. I know that those were your fancy words of just trying to talk about God in a roundabout way. And I didn't believe in God. I was all done with that. I came up with that. I went to parochial schools, and I felt like I was really finished with that. I thought it was ridiculous. I thought people who believed in God were people who are not intelligent enough to think for themselves. And clearly, if you had the stellar intellect that I have, you would be capable of solving your own problems without needing to, be so mushy as to rely on something like that. So I came to AA, and back of my mind, I wasn't conscious of thinking this, but I really, on some level, I think that I was waiting for the opportunity to come where I was going to be able to drink like a normal person. And so what I did was I got married, and I thought that the secret to being successful was to just not live this trashy life. You know, I grew up in the suburbs. I went to parochial school. My parents did not raise me to drink alcoholically or to run around with some of the people I ran around with in the ghetto. And so it made sense to me to go to college. It made sense to me to get married and have a family. And this is the kind of daughter I was. I got accepted to a fancy school, and it was about an hour and 15 minutes away from where I lived. So my father bought me a car so that I could drive to that school and commute and live at home and not have to pay anything. And I did that first semester, and then it was just too stressful for me to have to commute an hour and 15 minutes to go to this school. And so I decided that it would be better to go live there. And so my father bought an apartment worth of furnishing for me. And I took the car and I moved to Charlottesville so I could go to this college. And I don't think I was there but about 9 months when it became really clear to me that AA in Charlottesville isn't any good. And and it's almost as bad as AA in Fredericksburg. And, you know, there weren't any good people to be friends with, and there wasn't a lot of good stuff to do. And I was studying a lot of classes in school, and it started to occur to me that, you know, I'm probably not really an alcoholic. I mean, I probably just was young, and, I mean, who doesn't party like that when they're young? I mean, seriously, who does not? Everyone steals cars and shoplifts, steals money and credit cards and smokes crack cocaine. And, you know, everybody does that when they're young, right? And then I was studying this class. I was studying anthropology, and it just really started occurring to me that, like, alcoholism is this American phenomenon. And I thought, it's just another way that the sociologists try to explain our excessive American behavior. And it's not a world-found disease whatsoever. It's just like another hoax, you know, by the man. Thank God. Thank God I'm smart enough to see through, you know, the charades that are out there that people would have us to believe. So I started to drink again. And it used to be when I would tell my story, I would tell you that I had these periods of controlled drinking while I was having babies. And that is true, because I had 4 more children and I did have these periods of controlled drinking. But the other day it occurred to me that I also had like morning sickness when I would be pregnant for like the first 5 months. And I couldn't stomach alcohol. And I don't know if I hadn't had that, if I hadn't been physically unable to drink, I wonder, you know, if that might have looked different than it did. But I had these 4 other children, and I would have these periods where I wouldn't drink when I was pregnant until the end of a pregnancy, and I did drink at the end of the last 3 pregnancies. And I used to think it wasn't very often, but now that I think about it, it was like 3 to 4 times a week. I would have at least 2 to 3 drinks. And it's funny how, for me, as a little bit of time goes by, that I'm able to see things I couldn't see. So I had these babies, and I thought I was just going to have this good family, and I had married this person that I had met in recovery who was also drinking again, and our life just became very miserable and unhappy. And I also used to think that I was a stay-at-home mom, and I had these babies at home with midwives, and, you know, we ate organic food, and seriously, you know, they're not going to have any kind of preservative in them except for, like, the sulfites that come in wine. Because I breastfed them, and I was drunk all the time when I breastfed them. And, gosh, I really thought that I was having this wholesome experience for homeschooling them, and that's just such delusion, because in reality, that's not what was happening. She's laughing. My sponsor is laughing because she's also my neighbor. So aside from hearing my story, she got to see how I lived when she was my neighbor. The reality was that I would get up in the morning, and I knew that it was not okay to drink alcohol first thing in the morning, because that's what alcoholics do, so I would have to use other substances to get through to the drinking hour. And I'm not a drug addict. I am an alcoholic. I've used a lot of other substances to manage my alcoholism. And so I'd have to do something until, you know, the drinking hour, which was typically around 4 o'clock in the afternoon for me, unless it was on the weekend, and then it was okay to drink in the morning because that was brunch. And it's true. And if you have a Bloody Mary, you also get some vitamin C. I wasn't educating these kids at all. They were playing around barefoot outside all the livelong day in the creek, playing with animals. They were so poorly educated that when I was beginning to get sober and I put them back into school, 2 of them had to go to summer school and have tutors in order to stay on grade level. And I would drink, and when my ex-husband would come home in the evening, we would fight. And my ability to be a wife was not any better than my ability to be a daughter. I thought that it was his responsibility to make me be happy. And I was very resentful and disappointed and angry that he did not do that for me. And the truth of that is that no one ever made me happy. You know, not from before I was 14 and I had that first drink. Nothing ever has been enough for me. You can say nice things to me about me, and I think you're lying. You can do things for me, and I'm disappointed that you didn't do it right. Nothing, nobody could make me happy. Nobody. And I was miserable, angry, irritable person. And when I drank alcohol for a long time, that irritation went away. And then there came a time when it did not matter how much I drank. I still, inside, I felt like I was a piece of garbage. And I felt as if I was just defective. I was broken. I did not know how to get along. And I did not understand why that was. I did not understand why my friends would break up with me. My relationships didn't go well. I had an intense fear of participating in life, which ran alongside of these really grandiose ideas of the fabulous things that I was going to accomplish. And I'm the kind of person who would like come up with a great idea in a certain situation and say, let's do this. You know, and here's an example. And I know in our book it talks about how the alcoholic builds a bright future for himself and then pulls it down. And that's me. And, you know, I wanted to head up this statewide fundraiser to raise money for this cause I passionately believed in. And for about a year, I was the chairperson of this, and I emailed people and I phoned people, and we were going to have this 5K race, and I raised all of this money, and I worked so hard, and I thought this is going to be like an annual event, and 20 years from now, they're going to invite me, the person who had the idea, to come back and talk about how I got this off the ground. And what happened was I woke up the morning of the event, and I was so frightened to show up and see the people there, because what was happening to me is my life was coming undone. The craziness that was running around inside of my head and in my heart and in my house was becoming so big that I could not hide it from the world anymore. It was just spilling out. It was oozing out of my pores. It was spilling out of the cracks in the door. I'd have to see my neighbors going out to my car and wonder, did they see the police cars there? Did they hear the yelling the night before? Are my children telling my friends? One of the classics is one of my sons telling my sponsor, before she was my sponsor and she was my neighbor, how my ex-husband was on an extended vacation, which is secret talk for being in jail. And this, everything was coming undone. And I woke up that morning and I could not go to that event and face these people. I was so frightened that they were going to see through me and they were going to see that the reality was that I'm a crazy woman inside. I'm a piece of garbage. And I knew I couldn't have some drinks and show up there at 8 o'clock in the morning. But I don't know how to go outside of my house anymore, not under the influence of something. And so I used something else. And I went there and I was so intoxicated when I got there that my job, which was to flag the course, I couldn't remember the route for the course. So we just put flags on the ground. And what was supposed to be 3.2 miles was like 1 mile. And the runners were back in, you know, less than 10 minutes, and they were very disappointed. And I look at that today and I think, look at how selfish that is. But it's representing a statewide organization that was a little tiny grassroots organization that struggled to find its position and was fighting for years and years for legislature in the General Assembly. And that I, as the representative of that, that's what I presented to anyone who might be interested in that cause. You know, and I was just ruled by this level of fear. And I don't know what happened. Other than that, it just became so painful I couldn't take it anymore. And I would drink and drink and drink. And that awful loneliness, and that just incredible pain, you know, that pain that feels like someone has just ripped my heart out. And I might as well die because I can't make anything good happen in this world. That just would not go away anymore. That was with me all the time. And I would go to, like, the Target, and I'd have a panic attack because I thought that other people in the Target would be able to look at me and see that I was this piece of garbage, that I was just this empty, crazy person. And I just started spilling over and I started telling people just craziness. The woman who worked at the grocery store on the corner from my house that I saw every night at 5 minutes to 11 before the food line closed and I had to hurry up and buy some more alcohol. And I would just go in there and blather to her, just crazy talking stuff to her. And she would just say, Jen, I'll pray for you. And what happened for me is 2 weeks before I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was sitting in my car in the parking lot of this grocery store and I was just weeping. And I just didn't understand. I felt like I'm so smart. I was brought up with all the advantages. All these people I know who came up with the background that I came up with were successful. And I have all these things. I have a family. I have a husband. I have a house. And yet everything is falling apart and doesn't make sense and it hurts. And everywhere I look, I just feel alone and I just feel crushed. I feel crushed. And I felt as if someone had reached in my chest and just ripped my heart out, and I just wanted to die. And I said, if there is a God out there, please take this pain away from me. I don't know why I said that. This, I think, really is my first surrender, where it occurs to me that I've exhausted all of my stellar capabilities, and I have nothing to show for that. And I did not have this, like, you know, burning bush where all this pain went away, but I did have the experience of feeling as if I was not alone. I immediately had this sensation that I wasn't alone, and it was so overwhelming to me that I called a friend of mine and I said, this is what happened to me. This is what I said. This is what I felt. I feel like I have had a spiritual experience. And this is a woman who's not an alcoholic, but she's been on a spiritual path all her life. And quietly was my friend and modeled that for me. And she said, yes, that is what's happening. And about 2 weeks later, another set of circumstances happened that really, for me, when I read with my sponsor, incomprehensible demoralization, that's what happened to me. I just had the worst, awfulest experience beyond the scope of anything I could have imagined. And in a moment, all the way in my heart, down to every pore in my body, I understood that I was an alcoholic. You know, this awful thing had happened to me because I invited it in because I was drinking. And I did not want to live like that anymore. And that surrender happened for me 17 years after the first time I came to you in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what a relief to know that I am an alcoholic and to just know that all the way down to the bone. And in all of its manifestations. And so I came back to you, and you were the same. And in fact, I've had the experience of even going back to Fredericksburg and seeing some of the same people still sitting in the rooms as were there when I was 15 and my mom sat beside me. And yet I heard something totally different here this time. Totally different. What I heard here this time was that God could do for me what I've been looking for forever. And all I had to do were these very basic and simple actions. And wow. And I understand today what people mean when they say it's simple. It really is simple. It's not easy. It's not easy. It goes against my very lazy nature to do most of what I'm asked to do here. And it truly goes against my nature to have to evaluate myself with under the direction of someone who cares about me, because I would much rather that it could be your fault. Much rather. And so I came here for 4 months. I went to one meeting a week, and I just got sicker and sicker. I did not get better from going to one meeting a week. I don't think Alcoholics Anonymous works so much so well without taking the actions of the steps. But I was disappointed that the dollar in the basket once a week wasn't fixing me. And at the end of that 4 months, I was sitting in this meeting in the group that was my first home group, and, you know, they were like, does anyone have a topic? Pick me. You know, I'm so unhappy, and I don't understand. I'm not drinking, and I could not stop thinking about killing myself. I just, on a daily basis, I fantasized about that. I even became, I was so desperate and sick at the point where I thought that it would be a good idea to just drive my car with my children in it off the bridge into the river, because it would be easier for them to just die with me than to live through their mother's suicide. Now, how is that as a beautiful explanation of how selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem? And at the end of that meeting, Sammy and Meg pulled me aside and explained to me that I wasn't doing what was being suggested here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I might like to consider going to more than one meeting a week and finding a sponsor and working the steps. And so I went to that second meeting that week, and I came in and I was late. I feel like the readings at that time, I felt like the readings were for you to allow time for additional parking. And I came in, and there was this one seat, and this woman, Lana, was sitting there, and it was up in the front, and she gestured to me to come, and she was rubbing my back, and she was so loving and kind. And I look across from me, and there's my neighbor, who is today my sponsor. And I was just ready to do what was asked of me. And I don't know how to describe that other than that just happens. It's a moment, and you know when that happens. And I don't think that what I was willing to do then is the same as what I'm willing to do today. But I was willing to do what I was capable of then. And it did not make sense to me. And in my mind, I thought that, and I love you very much, Marcy, and I mean no harm, but I just thought, she's not as smart as me. I don't know why I'm taking direction from her. And she showed me what to do, so that God could save my life. She showed me what to do so that if I showed up and I took those actions, God could save my life. And that's what happens here. And I want to tell you about a couple of things that have happened to me, some surrenders I've had in sobriety. And one is about my daughter, and the other is about my dad. And my daughter, my oldest daughter, she was just being crazy. I mean, she's smoking pot and drinking and sneaking out and getting into all this trouble. And I was calling Al, and what do I do? And Al's direction to me was that I should go to 4 meetings a week, and I should follow the suggestions of my sponsor. He didn't hear what I said. And I wrote a lot of inventory about her, and I had a lot of fights with her, and I hurt her in sobriety. In sobriety, I hit her. And I pulled her hair, and I put her outside the front door once when
when she was naked wearing a towel. Because she wouldn't do what I said to do. That's the kind of mother that I am capable of being on my own. And about 6 months ago, she stopped getting into trouble. And about 4 months ago, I bought this book that had a daily meditation prayer for a parent to do for a child. And the premise of the prayers are how God has asked us to be a steward to our children, that they are His, and they are here to walk their path with Him, and we are here to be a steward for them. And she just stopped getting in trouble. And yesterday I met with a woman who called me on the telephone Thursday, and she said, I got your telephone number from this other woman that I used to sponsor that I took to treatment center and sat with her a whole day while it took for them to process her. And God, this woman made me crazy. I was so happy when she fired me, okay? And this other lady calls me Thursday and she says, you know, this lady gave me her phone number and I am graduating from an IOP and I need a sponsor. Will you be my sponsor? And I said, well, let's meet. So we meet. And about 30 minutes into the conversation, what comes out is that her daughter and my daughter are friends at school. And my daughter's been telling me about this woman, but I just didn't know it was her because we'd never met. And she'd been telling me about how this woman's alcoholism was unfolding and what was happening in their family and how she was trying to console her friend. And this woman told me that the night after her last drink, my daughter was there at their house spending the night with some other girls. And the other girls were upstairs. And my daughter sat with this woman. And she told this woman about me. And how I had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And how by doing what was asked of me, you gave me back to her. Did you see how amazing God is and how this is bigger than us? And I'll tell you this other story about my dad. About a year ago, I took, my sponsor was out of town, and I took this, you know, ugly inventory to another woman in my sponsorship family. And I read to her, and as I was leaving, she had these rose bushes in her yard that I admired. And she said, next year when I send them out, you may ask them if you want to put them in your yard. So about 3 or 4 weeks ago, she remembered, and I got a phone call from her saying, I know you like these roses, and I put them in my yard. You can come and get them. So I thought, I'm so busy. I don't have time to plant roses. I don't even know how busy I am. No appreciation for the sensitivity of this person to think of me a year later. Here's someone turned outward a year later. I went by because I felt obligated because she called me and I didn't want her to think poorly of me. So I went and I went and picked these flowers up, and I was going to my mom and dad's the Wednesday after Easter so they could have an egg hunt with my children, and I thought, I'll take some to my dad. Now, my dad is an avid gardener, and when I was a little girl, I would help my dad in his garden, and he would tell me about plants and which ones he had brought down from his dad's house and what they need and how they grow. And also, in the evenings, my dad would take me on a walk with him in our neighborhood, and he would tell me about the stars in the sky and what the constellations were. One time we kept a record of the moon so that we could see how Easter falls, because it's based on the moon patterns. So I get up there and we're going to have this Easter egg hunt. My dad does this traditionally for my children, and one year when I was drinking, we were there to have it, and I got into an argument with my mother about the war in Iraq, and I made all the children get in the car and drive all the way home to Richmond before they could look for their Easter eggs, because my mother would not be smart enough as to agree with me. That's the kind of daughter that I am. So I show up, and I bring these rose bushes to my dad, and my dad and I spent about an hour in the backyard at his house, and we planted these plants, and he told me, you know, what they need and how you transplant a rose, and he was directing me on how to water them. I need to water them very slowly because it's been so dry. I don't want the water to run off. I want it to soak down. So he's telling me, slow, slow, slow. Not that slow. Not that slow. And then after that, my dad and I went for a walk. They have some woods, and he had cleared a trail. And he and I took my kids, and we went for this walk. And he showed us where the pileated woodpecker lived, and where lightning had struck a tree, and where the edge of the property line was. And I had such a nice time. It was incredible. And I got in the car and I drove home and I thought, my dad has always been like that. And I missed it. I didn't know how to show up for that. I'm his only daughter. Of course he wanted to take a walk with me in the woods. You know, be a part of my family and my wedding and all the things that dads do. He gave and he gave and he gave to me unconditionally, even when I was awful. Even when I was so drunk that at 28 years old, I jumped into their bed at 3 o'clock in the morning to wake them up and tell them why they had always loved my brother better than me, and they always did for my brother better than they did for me. I spent that night in jail. That's what happens when I drink. So I went home and I wrote an email to this friend and I said, thank you for remembering about these flowers, because this is part of the gift that you as a person in Alcoholics Anonymous gave to my family on that day. And you have no idea how meaningful that was to me. And she wrote me back and she said, those rose bushes came from her father from Bulgaria. And he brought them over here and transplanted them here and gave her some to take to her home. She moved into a home. So I was having this tough time about a month and a half ago. Been graduated from college and I've been looking for a job and it's not working out. And my friend Cliff was reminding me that, you know, God will come through at the 11th hour. And I thought, well, that's fine, God, but I don't do so good after 10 p.m. You know, come on. And I'm just getting more and more frightened. You know, how am I going to take care of all of these kids? I need a job. I need money. You know, I don't understand what level of faith is being requested of me. And I had to write more inventory. And my sponsor was out of town again. You see how she does this? So I had to go read this inventory to another woman. And I took her, like, 2 hours worth of just disgusting self-pity, self-loathing inventory. Self-loathing. This is what my selfishness and my self-centeredness looks like. I've been such a self-hater forever. And lurking in the back of my mind is, if I don't do AA right, or if I am not a good enough mother, or if I'm not a good enough student, or blah, 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 God's not going to give me what God gives to you. And constantly I look at you and I see that you're at this better spot than me. And I wonder what's wrong with me that I'm not entitled to get the good life that God has given to others. And I just read her like 2 hours of this. And Then I went down to this corrections conference with my sponsor and her sponsor in North Carolina. And I was so surrounded by love and care from these two women while they were there. They made my bed, you know. They bought all my meals. They paid for the hotel. They brought me coffee in the morning. I got to watch my sponsor's sponsor fix my sponsor's hair so that my sponsor could go speak. And I was sitting there thinking, what a nurturing and loving thing that is to see a woman taking care of another woman. And I got to listen to people speak who are in prison, who missed the opportunity, or who were in prison, who missed the opportunity of being with their children. And I thought, all these times I'm so resentful that I have to take care of all these babies and my life is so hard, and yet I get to have that experience that some other alcoholics don't get to have at all. And I came home from there, and I was leaving my home group one night, and someone put a card in my purse with some money in it. And I thought, I've made this decision my whole life to just be this self-hater, to not allow myself to show up and enjoy the life of love and abundance that God has offered to me all along. It didn't just become abundant and loving because I stopped drinking. It was there the whole time, and I chose not to take any action to participate in it. And I got to see that here I am, so blessed to live this life, to be in a community of women in Alcoholics Anonymous who love me and who love each other and care for one another and who are so willing to show up over and over and over again and take the actions of being of service to me and my fellows that allows me to see what God can do in this world. And if I choose to show up and participate in that, I can be so full of that love that it can overflow from me unto another person, unto my children. How could I not want to show up and take the actions that are here and be a part of that? All I've been asked to do is to go to some meetings and to look at myself, to be willing to get rid of anything that is in my way of having that kind of life. And so this last week I was thinking, now is my time to choose to surrender that self-hatred that I have chosen to participate in for so long. You know, that's my alcoholism talking to me. That's just another way that it winds its wicked threads into my head and tells me I'm not as good as you. I will never be as successful as you. Something's wrong with me. I don't feel good. I don't feel good. Do you know what that means? Do you ever have that I don't feel good experience? Am I the only alcoholic who sometimes doesn't feel good? It's not about that at all. And strangely enough, when I can stay focused on that, that here's this life of love and abundance that I get to participate in receiving and giving to others, I don't have to feel quite so bad, because when I'm busy concerning myself of how do I show that love to you, I'm not thinking about how I feel. It's so amazing. What a gift. And last weekend we were at the Serenity Weekend Conference, and a woman there asked me, would I like to go to lunch with some of the ladies? And I said, sure. And she said, Jen, this is Sharon. I said, hi, Sharon. And we're driving over there, and I realized, oh, this is the speaker, Sharon. And when I had this job in D.C. and I was driving up there, I loved to listen to her CD. I listened to it over and over, and I thought, what a gift that I get to meet this lady face-to-face because she's been so helpful to me on her CD. And I was badly dressed because I thought it was going to be warm, and I was cold, and I got out of the car, and we were parked a far way away from the restaurant. And she put her arm around me, and she said, oh, are you cold? And I said, I am. And we joked around. And she walked me all the way into that restaurant with her arm around me. And she doesn't know me, you know? And there's that minute where I was very uncomfortable. Like, is she going to stop hugging me? What do I do? Do I put my arm around her? Would that be weird? So I'm thinking, did I put enough deodorant on? You know, I was very uncomfortable for a minute, and then something occurred to me, like, just relax and enjoy this minute, Jen. And I just walked up to that door, and I thought, that is the kind of woman that I want to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to be that full of love that I can just put my arm around a stranger and walk them to the door. And a little while ago, we were at the Oceanfront Conference, and I was there with some friends, and we were going to go eat, and I was the only woman with my people. There were like four other women who were from Fredericksburg, and so I said, you know, I'm going to go ride with the ladies, and the ladies were a little bit ahead, and I thought, this would be nice, I meet these other ladies, so I run and catch up, and I'm like, hey, can I ride with you ladies? And they were like, sure. And we get over to the car, and it's this little tiny Mustang. And I was so embarrassed because I thought, here I've invited myself in and there isn't room for me in this car. And this woman said, no, there's room, I'll ride on my hump. And she jumped in and she scooched over and she's this long, tall, beautiful woman. And she had to put her legs between the two seats and like her boots were touching the dashboard. She shoved over to pack me in. And I was telling my sponsor about this later, like, wow, like how graceful and gracious they were that they just shoved right over and let me in the car. And my sponsor said, I hope there's always room for one more. And that, I think, is what this is about, right? That I can surrender enough to my old ways of thinking, my philosophies, and my belief systems about God and myself, and I take these actions daily so there can always be room for one more person so that we can turn around and we can grab that person who's coming up behind us and make room for them. Even if our daughter is the one who 12 steps us. I think I'm done. Thank you.